For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, The Great Gatsby meets Swan Lake in Upon a Frosted Star, and a retelling of The Nutcracker in Midnight in Everwood, plus a sprinkling of pirates and something spooky. I'll be talking to the author of them all, M.A. Kushniar. Plus, on today's Read On, we'll find four new gems in the RNIB Talking Books library. All that and more on today's Read On. M.A. Kushniar is the author of Midnight in Everwood, a gothic twist on the story of the Nutcracker. And if you're listening to this on the day of broadcast, released yesterday was Upon a Frosted Star, a spellbinding fairy tale in which the Great Gatsby meets Swan Lake. She's also the author of a swashbuckling adventure for younger readers and has a spooky anthology coming for Halloween. We'll hear about all those books and the brand new Upon a Frosted Star later on. But Mia and I started our chat with Midnight in Everwood. In the darkness of night, magic awaits, and you will never forget what you find there. The audio version is read by Tor Leachton.
Mariette Estelle's mother always said that nothing good came of a rainy day. However, it was a rainy day when the magic came. And once magic has entered your life, you stay in its glittering clutch forever. A mysterious new neighbour, who Marietta would later come to learn, went by the name of Dr. Drosselmeyer, heralded the arrival of magic and wonder in her life. Though he appeared to be but an ordinary man, enchantment clung to him. It dripped from his voice, seeped out from under his skin, and whispered around his eyes. Marietta was dipping in and out of pliés at her ballet bar when she happened to glance out her window and witness his entrance. A black town hat bobbed along the cobbled street below. The cloak figure carried a single case, pausing to look up at the sprawling townhouse Marietta called home. He seemed to look straight through her, so Marietta took a step back from the window to study him from a more covert position. His face was clean-shaven, fair, and younger than one would expect, considering the sweep of silver hair peeking out from beneath his hat. Creases burrowed into the skin at the corners of his eyes, marking him as a gentleman in his late 30s, perhaps, and his irises were an intense, frosted blue, lending him a bewitching stare.
So, Midnight in Everwood is a retelling of The Nutcracker. It's set between Edwardian Nottingham and a fantasy world based on the Land of Sweets. So it follows Marietta. She is a young woman, absolutely desperate to become a professional ballerina. But since she was born in a certain era, to a certain family, her family expect her to marry and take up her place in society. And really, they've got no time for her dancing about on the stage, basically. So when a mysterious neighbour, who goes by the name of Dr. Drosselmeyer, moves into an empty townhouse on their street, a kind of series of events are set in motion for Marietta, and her life suddenly becomes very peculiar and enchanting, quite dark at times, but also deeply magical.
The curtains of rain sheeting down Marietta's windows failed to touch him, and after a momentary hesitation, he continued on his way. Rising up onto Demi Point, her attention snared. Marietta watched him stride into the equally grand vacated townhouse opposite the Stells. "We seem to have acquired a new neighbour," Frederick announced later at dinner. "Is that so?" their mother asked. She smoothed a hand over her honey-tinted coiffure, as if he were to make an appearance that instant.
So I take it you're a big fan of ballet.
Yes, I do love the ballet, yes, absolutely.
Because that love of ballet carries forward into your new book that we're really here to talk about, Upon a Frosted Star, which you've moved from Nutcracker to Swan Lake.
Yes, that's right. So Upon a Frosted Star is like Swan Lake meets The Great Gatsby. And it's set across the 1920s and follows Forster, who is a struggling artist who one night finds an invitation to this magical party. It's a very glamorous, bewitching, quite notorious party that happens every year on the first snowfall in this gorgeous abandoned manor house in Worthercliffe, which is a little town that has some woodland and a beautiful, mysterious little lake. So he quickly becomes obsessed with finding out who the mysterious host of these parties is. She is known to be a beautiful woman who performs a ballet solo at every party, but nobody knows who she is or why the manor is empty for the rest of the year. And Forster gets very, very drawn into this mystery.
It was a late November night when the wind was blowing like Father Frost and the Thames was near frozen solid that Forster wondered if he had been cursed. He had begun the day sitting in his kitchen sink. His sketch pad propped awkwardly upon one knee, he'd been attempting to capture the mellow sunshine seeping into their basement window and setting the whiskey glasses from last night aglow, like melted butter. Only, halfway through committing ink to paper, the light had shifted, leading Forster to abandon his efforts. He'd started and grown bored of another five sketches until the late afternoon ushered in a deep darkness that suited his sense of ennui. Not long after, the little mantel clock had chimed six, reminding him of his long-standing evening walk with his flatmate, and he had hurried out into the bracing temperature.
So while Midnight in Everwood is more of a direct retelling of The Nutcracker, as much as these things can ever be, Upon a Frosted Star is inspired by both Swan Lake and The Great Gatsby. So it's more of an original story, taking a lot of inspiration from those two classics. But yes, you can definitely see the ballet influences throughout it.
Also the F. Scott Fitzgerald influence as well, because the time period just after the First World War as well shares its time period with Great Gatsby.
Yes, that's right. And there are several spectacular parties in Upon a Frosted Star as well.
Now, the influences are easy to find in F. Scott Fitzgerald and Swan Lake, but there's also, is Worthercliffe based on Wuthering Heights?
Do you know, a few people have asked me that, and it was not intentional at all. It just popped into my head. But I, of course, do love Wuthering Heights, so I wouldn't be surprised if there is a subconscious influence there. But it was not done deliberately. It would have been very clever of me to say, oh, yes, absolutely. But I have to be completely honest. No, I didn't intentionally do that.
Now, Midnight in Everwood is narrated by Tor Leachton. I think I've got that correct. Did you have any choice in the narrator?
Yes, I did. So what was very interesting, Upon a Frosted Star and both Midnight in Everwood are published by HQ Stories, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. And what was very interesting with their process for the audiobooks is that they hold auditions for them. They team up with an acting school called East 15, which I think is in Essex. And they hold open auditions with students there, either postgrad or undergrad, for the role of the narrator, which I really like because it's giving, you know, young people who are getting started in their career a paid job, an opportunity to try something they might be interested in. And of course, it is a lot of fun getting to watch those auditions with the HarperCollins audio team.
Now, listeners listening to this on the day it was released, the book came out yesterday, but at the time of recording, the book hasn't been narrated as yet, but we have got two narrators for this book.
Yes, we have, which is very exciting, and I loved getting to pick them both. We have Jamie Miles, who is doing Forster's voice, which is a male point of view, and most of the chapters are written in that voice, so he's doing the bulk of it, and he's got a great voice. I'm very excited to hear him do his thing. And then we also have flashbacks to a mysterious ballerina called Detta and her days dancing in an enchanted theatre. And those flashbacks are going to be narrated by Christina Paraccio, who has this beautiful voice. It was very ethereal, almost haunting. So I felt it was just perfect for that fairy tale feel, but with a bit of a darker edge as well. So I think they make the perfect combination. And I can't tell you how excited I am to listen to them narrate the whole book.
I saw you do some readings on YouTube. Do you not fancy narrating any of your books yourself?
I mean, I think I'll leave that to the professionals. I do enjoy reading little snippets of my book, but I don't think I would be as good as them reading out the whole thing. They do it in a very intense period of time, around 3 days, I think. So it's quite a task.
Now, as you say, the books has two different points of view from Dessa and Forster. Was that hard as a writer to keep track?
The different points of view were not hard to keep track. The timeline was a bit of a nightmare because it's set across 4 or 5 years across the 1920s. And, well, this was the hardest book I've ever written to date and definitely my biggest challenge. It took me 2 full years to draft and edit it, which is quite a while you're on contract with a publisher. So yeah, definitely went through a few rewrites.
What's your writing style like? Are you a planner or a pantser?
I'm a happy mixture. So I have to have the main beats of the story planned out. And I always have to know how it's going to begin and how it's going to end and sort of kind of the route that my characters will take along the way. But I do leave room for lots of surprises, and my characters do like to surprise me. So the main kind of story, the main plot, I definitely plot out. But then scenes with the characters, little things to add in, those are all surprises to me that I kind of come up with along the way.
Do you ever use audio as you're writing? Like, for example, do you read it back to yourself to make sure the dialogue's working?
Yes, I do like to do a full read out loud of one of my drafts when it hits a certain point and where I have more words than bullet points, just to capture the rhythm of it and the almost the poetry of the prose and make sure that it all, you know, flows nicely.
The Ship of Shadows by Maria Kuznia, read by Maya Soroya. Aleja was a girl so hungry for adventure that sometimes she found herself in strange places. Tonight, she was prowling the rooftops of Sevilla when she should have been sleeping, having stuffed a pillow under her bedsheets back home. Scrambling from one roof to another, Aleja ventured deep into the oldest part of the city. Here the buildings loomed up, creating ramshackle paths. Crumbling stones tested Aleja's balance as she half-climbed, half-crawled along a narrow ledge. In the great domes and spires, she imagined palaces, castles, and cathedrals, and the stories their stones could tell, tales entrusted to kings and queens and explorers and scholars. Night was the best time for creeping along in the shadows, feeling the whisperings of the city in her blood. Up here, she could explore a whole new layer of her city, and she loved it. Sweet Sevilla was scented with orange blossom and moored in history.
Now, we have more of your books in the RNIB Talking Books Library. The Ship of Shadows, which is a bit of a swashbuckling adventure for a different audience. Give us a little description of The Ship of Shadows.
Oh, of course. So The Ship of Shadows was my first book to be published, and I'm very fond of it. It's a globe-trotting adventure series for children. So it's about ages 8 to 12, I should say. And it's set in the golden age of piracy, with an all-female pirate ship, a hunt for a magical map, and then you have this ship that's filled with shadows and all kinds of magic, including rooms that appear and disappear randomly, storms and jars that they can use as weapons and sort of throw at people, hit them with lightning, kraken, and plenty of cupboards filled with cake, because I think a children's book is best read with lots of cake in it. The audiobook is narrated by Maya Soraya. Hopefully I'm saying that right, she just did a brilliant job bringing it to life and all the action and adventure and friendship. So I do love that book. It has a very special place in my heart.
The darkness keeping her hidden from the ancient streets below, Aleja leaped across to another rooftop and then ran across a flat white roof. Her little knapsack flapped against her back and she jumped as far as she could into the sky. Just for a moment,
It felt like she was flying. And then she hit the opposite wall with her arms outstretched, and all the breath rushed out of her. As she scrambled to a safer position, Aleja grinned to herself. The city belonged to her. She stared at the sails in the distance. Huge ships slunk in and out of the river port, full and heavy like gigantic sea beasts that had gorged themselves on riches. Sometimes, she knew, a ship would sail up the river with great chunks missing. Sailors would claim it had been attacked by monsters that lurked beneath the waves. Giant kraken and leviathans and sirens with haunting songs were all waiting to take a bite out of the passing ships. Sometimes the boats didn't come back at all.
The Ship of Shadows by Maria Kuzniar, as narrated by Maya Soroa. Available from RNIB Talking Books. Now back to Upon a Frosted Star. One thing we don't get if we're downloading the book from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you describe the cover for us?
Oh, of course. So the cover of Upon a Frosted Star is a very dark green. It's kind of peppered with tiny little stars. The title, Upon a Frosted Star, is set in big, swirly letters on the front in shiny gold foil. And underneath that, you have a very elegant white swan, and she's sitting gracefully on her lake. And there's lots of nice little details of her wings and, you know, very pretty swan. And the lake is also a very dark green with little shiny gold ripples. And then all around the edges of the cover, framing both the title and the swan, are flowers and leaves, nice big flowers and leaves. They're depicted in Art Deco style, so it feels very 1920s aesthetically. And they're in different shades of green with little bits of gold detailing.
And I believe next month there's something spooky on its way.
That's right. I have co-curated a YA anthology called A Taste of Darkness with my co-curator and one of my best friends, Amy McCaw. And that's been a lot of fun to do as a little project on the side. I have a YA short story in it, which is like a Polish retelling of Little Red Riding Hood, but in a lot more grown-up sense and a lot spookier. I had a lot of fun writing it. And there are 13 stories in total with a brilliant coven of, you know, just fantastic authors that have all put their creepiest, best scary stories into it. So it's a perfect anthology to curl up with on a nice sort of chilly October night.
A Taste of Darkness should be out by Halloween. As we said in the interview, Upon a Frosted Star hadn't been recorded at the time of this interview, but hopefully we'll hear a clip now.
November had whirled into London like a storm, frosting the spires and domes, and leaving Forster with a childlike longing for snow. This was heightened by the sense of roasted chestnuts drifting along the embankment. He set off in search of the cart and parted with a few coins for a bag. The paper warmed his hands as he made his way to a bench overlooking the river. Beside him, the light from a solitary street lamp puddled onto the cobblestones as he stared out at the boats drifting past like his thoughts. They set the river aglow with their cosy lantern light, and he wished one would anchor. Perhaps he ought to learn how to sail. Then he could purchase a small boat that was in some disarray and spend time learning how to fix it, polishing it until it gleamed on the water like a pearl, and sleeping out on deck, watching the stars spattered out over the roof of the world. But what of his decision to dedicate his life to art? He'd spent the better part of this year attempting to search out of a lone spark of inspiration, but the muses had turned their faces from him, and his sketchbooks were filled with half-formed pictures. Perhaps he had been cursed by some hidden malevolence, leaving him destined never to finish them. Sometimes they became flesh and slipped into his nightmares. A woman that had no face, a city never finished, and a man that was not whole. These nightmares had intensified now he had entered the final year of his 20s last month. 29. Another decade near completed without him making his mark on the world.
Jamie Miles narrating from the brand new Upon a Frosted Star. Sections are also narrated by Christina Paraccio. It's available commercially now and will be on its way to the RNIB Talking Books Library. Available now in the Talking Books Library are Midnight in Everwood and The Ship of Shadows. Anbiya Kujnir, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Mia will be back at the end of the show with the books of her life. Coming up in a moment, we'll find four new gems in the RNIB Talking Books Library. That's coming up after this.
Hello, I'm Ray Sawyer. I've been reading for the RNIB Talking Books for 25 years now. My first book was Coming From Behind by Howard Jacobson, but the one I think I enjoyed most was Writing Home by Alan Bennett. Not just because it's wonderful writing, but although not officially an autobiography, you've got a sense of his life as all his selections of writings were put in chronological order. I particularly like The Lady in the Van. The Talking Book studios, as now, were very close to where Alan Bennett lived, and I was able to walk up and actually see the driveway and the house in which the lady lived for 25 years. And quite by chance, Alan Bennett was sitting on his front step reading The Guardian when I turned up.
This van, there were to be three others in the course of the next 20 years, was originally brown. But by the time it had reached the Crescent, it had been given a coat of yellow. Miss S was fond of yellow. It's the papal colour. And was never content to leave her vehicles long in their original trim. Sooner or later, she could be seen moving slowly round her immobile home, thoughtfully touching up the rust from a tiny tin of primrose paint, looking, in her long dress and sun hat, much as Vanessa Bell would have looked had she gone in for painting Bedford vans. Miss S. never appreciated the difference between car enamel and ordinary gloss paint, and even this she never bothered to mix. The result was that all her vehicles ended up looking as if they'd been given a coat of badly made custard or plastered with scrambled egg. Still, there were few occasions on which one saw Miss Shepherd genuinely happy, and one of them was when she was putting paint on.
I love doing the Talking Books because, well, you get to play parts that you'd never get to play in real life. In fact, doing a book is a bit like doing a one-man show, only one that's 25 hours long.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Celebrating 20 years of RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, I'm Ali Prince and I present the Folk and Roots Show here on RNIB Connect Radio, and it goes out every week. Coincidentally, the show was first broadcast in October 2016, which was pretty much the same time that RNIB Connect Radio was becoming a teenager. My favourite interview was, in fact, one done with me by Stephen Scott, who was then a presenter on the radio station. He interviewed me in some depth, and it was broadcast before the show first went out and immediately afterwards also. What was special about it was that it was actually confirmation that I was doing it. I'd spent a lot of time with the producer in London working on the show, being trained and mentored, and then there it was. And it was wonderful to hear the interview because it said to me, you're going to be on the air. And it's rather like the train leaving the station. The journey had begun.
RNIB Connect Radio, celebrating 20 years of broadcasting around the UK.
Hello, this is Emma Sams from Dynasty, The Colbys, and an American television show called General Hospital. I'm here with my husband, Simon McCoy, the esteemed broadcaster. Simon McCoy, say hello.
Hello, and I understand it's the 20th anniversary of your radio station in September, so many congratulations for that, and thank you for all the work that you do.
Yes, so we are actually wanting to congratulate all at Connect Radio and everybody at RNIB for the great work that you all do, bringing information and music to visually impaired listeners and their families and friends. So bravo, congratulations, and keep it up.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now let's find four new books in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Harriet Tice is a popular psychological thriller author, and we have her new title, It Ends at Midnight, which was donated by Wildfire from the Hachette Publishing Group.
You won! I won! I say, suppressing my grin. The victim's family are standing nearby at the door of court, and I don't want to rub it in. My client's mum might be delighted that his sentence has been cut by the appeal court from 12 years to 8, but judging by the mutterings and dark looks I'm being thrown, they're less than pleased. I don't know how you sleep at night, a man says, pushing past me to join the family. I pull my gown more closely around me, tipping my head so my wig obscures my eyes. Ignore him, my solicitor, Yona, says. He's not trying to suppress his smile. He looks delighted. It's a brilliant result.
It's New Year's Eve, and the stage is set for a lavish party in one of Edinburgh's best postcodes. It's a moment for old friends to set the past to rights and move on. The night sky is alive with fireworks, and the champagne is flowing. But the celebration fails to materialise, because someone at this party is going to die tonight. Midnight approaches, and the countdown begins, but it seems one of the guests doesn't want a resolution. They want revenge.
We got what we wanted, I say. Let me get changed and we'll get out of here. Drink? He says, looking from me to our client's parents, who are standing beside us. I nod, but they shake their heads. It's been a long day, the father says. Thank you, though. We know he's still going to be in prison for a long time, but at least we can see the end of it now. I'll see you out of the building, Yona says to them. He turns to me before he goes. Dailies? I nod again, before skirting round the hostile group to get to the robing room where I change quickly, folding my gown up and ramming it into my red bag along with my wig and my papers. Normally it's my trusty wheelie bag, but not today. Appearances at the Court of Appeal are rare enough that they warrant the use of the bag that was given to me by my first pupil master, my mentor, the top QC in chambers after the kidnapping trial that we did together. He'll be pleased with today's result. I'm pleased too. It all went off exactly as I'd hoped. Better, even.
Nice one, Sylvie.
The barrister for the prosecution calls out to me. I'm about to walk out of the main doors of the Royal Courts of Justice. I turn to face him, moving back into the hall.
You did well, he continues.
I look at him closely, wondering if there's a note of condescension lurking underneath.
It Ends at Midnight by Harriet Tice is read by George Waitman, Lucy Patterson and Samara McLaren, and runs for 8 hours 23 minutes.
So Help Me Golf, Why We Love the Game by Rick Riley is now in the library thanks to Headline.
When I was 30, I found the worst course in America, which turned out to be Ponkapog Golf Course outside Boston, a course that would have to undergo a federal urban renewal to be considered a dump. I had so much fun there among the inmates at Ponky, I never wanted to leave. They'd play sevensomes. They'd hit each other's balls backward. They'd putt for dollars by car headlight. I wound up writing a comic golf novel out of it, Missing Links, and it's still going strong. Which was why I was delighted to find a group of idiots in Colorado who were just as sick about golf as the Ponkies. Everything you could think of was allowed. Complimentary presses, in-flight presses, and that was just on the first tee.
This is the book Rick Riley has been writing in the back of his head since he fell in love with the game of golf at 11 years old. He unpacks and explores all the wonderful, maddening, heart-melting, heart-breaking, cool and captivating things about golf that make the game so utterly addictive. We meet the PGA Tour player who robbed banks by night to pay his motel bills, the golf club maker who takes weekly psychedelic trips, and the caddy who kept his loop even after an 11-year prison stint. We learn how a man on his third heart nearly won the US Open, how a Vietnam POW saved his life playing 18 holes a day in his tiny cell, and about the course that's absolutely free.
We'll visit the 18 most unforgettable holes around the world, Riley has played them all, including the hole in Indonesia where the biggest hazard is monkeys, and the one in the Caribbean that's underwater, and the one in South Africa that requires a shot over a pit of alligators, not to mention Riley's attempt to play in the most mini-golf holes in one day. Riley will admire and unload on all the great figures in the game, from Phil Mickelson to Bobby Jones, to the simple reason Jack Nicklaus is better than Tiger Woods, plus all the Greg Norman stories Riley has never been able to tell before. This is Riley's Valentine to golf, a cornucopia of stories that no golfer will want to be without.
The Usuals, I called them, and they included Sunshine, Simon the Likeable, and the ringleader, Lenny Two Down O'Connor, the world's most avid golf gambler, whose hair went straight up and whose drives went straight down and whose blood type was espresso. Two Down would double or nothing his mother in church bingo. One day, Two Down deemed that the seventh hole would hereafter be known as the Chuck Wagon. The team that lost that hole had to buy the grub at the snack shack behind the green. That was fine until one day we got to the seventh tee and saw a giant buffet table waiting with a white tablecloth, a candelabra, and a chef complete with giant white hat carving up prime rib. That's when Two Down hollered, "What's for lunch, cookie?" We Usuals traveled all over the country, beating each other out of the same $20 bill, then losing it in dice afterward, then winning it back the next morning on whether the waitress's first name started with a vowel. We'd give each other constant grief, laugh till our stomachs hurt, and never give an inch, all of which is the way guys say they love each other. We are still close today, proving that some links never go missing at all. When Christian Sanchez left his $35,000 a year job as a golf instructor and moved to Las Vegas, he thought maybe life would get a tad more exciting. Wrong. His life suddenly turned into a high-wire triple backflip with no net. It all started in 2009 when Sanchez was trying and failing to make a living on the Vegas mini tour and filling in the holes in his checkbook by teaching anybody who came along. That's when he met Daniel Negreanu. Negreanu is one of the world's biggest poker stars. He has 6 World Series of Poker bracelets and was named the Poker Player of the Decade in 2014. I don't get that. Why would it take him 4 years? If Negreanu sits down at your table, this is your cue to get up and leave. But when he took up golf, a whole mess of his money started flowing the wrong way. In the world of huge stakes golf gambling, Negreanu was the biggest pigeon in town.
So Help Me Golf, Why We Love the Game by Rick Riley is narrated by the author and lasts for 7 hours, 43 minutes.
For those who enjoy historical family stories, we have The Chimney Sweep's Sister by Emma Hornby, which was donated by Penguin Random House.
The last of the coal had been fed to the fire hours ago. Hands on hips, Jenny scanned through narrowed eyes the sparse single room of their cellar dwelling, and not for the first time, in search of an alternative to sacrifice for fuel. She hadn't 2 farthings to rub together until her brother arrived back from his toil later and would hand over his meagre daily wage, therefore buying in fresh supplies was out of the question. And she must have a fire if she was to cook. Young Noah would be ravenous upon his return. Furthermore, the temperature outside was cruel and only set to worsen with the hours. Numbers would be into the minuses by nightfall, she'd bet. Without warmth, they would surely catch their deaths from pneumonia before a new dawn rolled around. Think, think.
Orphaned Jenny and her chimney sweep brother Noah eke out life in a cellar dwelling in the heart of the slums. Noah is the main breadwinner, but he's treated horribly by his master. Worried for her brother's safety and health, Jenny resolves to put her talent for singing to good use and begins trawling the low inns and taverns at night, entertaining the punters.
When she catches the attention of a music hall manager and is offered a spot on the stage, it seems like a dream come true. But her newfound success can't include her brother. Will Jenny choose Noah over the bright lights of the theatre? And will he want her to?
Again, she took stock of their belongings, such as they were. The small battered table and two rickety stools set beneath the strip of high window. Two tin bowls, two mugs and two spoons stacked on the bare floor by the hearth beside the solitary black-bottomed cooking pot. The lumps of straw-filled sacking in the far alcove, atop which were folded neatly several threadbare blankets and matted shawls which served as their bed. However, there was nothing they could afford to part with. Every item was a necessary one and would only need replacing, meaning the loss of vital and precious pennies. Shrugging, her mind made up, she went to collect the small hatchet from the mantelpiece. The weapon swinging loosely in her hand, Jenny crossed to the steep set of wooden stairs to her right that led up to the front door. There had been 8 steps at one time, now but 5 remained. She bit her lip and contemplated whether the loss of a few more would hamper greatly their passing in and out of the home. Then desperation had her throwing caution to the wind and taking aim. She lifted the hatchet above her head. A fire was burning merrily in the grate, and the evening meal of scrag end stew was bubbling away nicely in the pot suspended from a hook above the flames, when footsteps from outside filtered down. Jenny craned her neck in readiness to welcome her brother, hastening to add as he opened the door, "Oh, lad, mind yon steps, there's a couple more gone." Noah accepted this news with an easy nod and deftly jumped the distance into the room. He hurried to the fire and held out his soot-encrusted hands to it gratefully. "Bye, it's cold out." "Aye." "I'm fair clemmed, our Jen." As though to cement the fact, his stomach released a low growl of hunger. "How long will the grub be?" She motioned to the table. "Not long, lad. Sit thee down and pour yourself a sup of tea whilst thou waits."
The Chimney Sweep Sister by Emma Hornby is read by Nikki Patel and runs for 8 hours 56 minutes.
Recently added to our history collection, Windrush, 75 Years of Modern Britain by Mike and Trevor Phillips, was donated by HarperCollins.
Interview with Lloyd Miller. Lloyd Miller came to Britain from Jamaica in 1949 and worked as a builder in Notting Hill.
"We didn't have much job, you know, things like that, but plenty of people work for themselves, you know? And like cultivating. After you cultivate, then you can send a little crop to, you know, to the higher one. They ship it away to go to England, Canada, you know, like banana. And what you're growing, you can ship it away, you know. So if you could put it this way, if you could make a few shillings for yourself, then you're all right. But if you couldn't make it, it was very hard. See, so that's the reason why I said to myself, I don't want to stop here to grow old and, you know, I want to travel and make something."
Broadcaster Trevor Phillips and his novelist brother Mike retell the very human story of Britain's first West Indian immigrants and their descendants from 1948 to the present day. In 1948, the troop ship Windrush brought the first West Indian immigrants to Great Britain. Originally published 50 years later, Trevor and Mike Phillips' seminal book uses the first-person accounts of those on boat, as well as those of their descendants, friends, neighbours and politicians, to tell the story of black British life in the 20th century. Moving through crucial events in black social history and tracing the impact of immigration throughout the decades, Windrush covers topics across politics, culture and society, from race riots to powerism to carnival and cricket. Updated to coincide with the 75th anniversary of the ship's voyage, including reflections on the legacy of Windrush in 2022, this compelling book is a true celebration of Black British history and heritage.
I went to St. Anne and stopped at a sugar estate there called Richmond and worked there for a while. That was about 59 miles from where I lived. I walked to go there, but you only have seasonal work in those places because the sugar-producing season, that only lasts about 6 months or thereabouts. You either go on further or you return to your place. I returned. It wasn't very profitable, but at least there was something to do. And so as the time went on, you travelled. Get in where you can, but those days were hard days. I had left Jamaica before. I went to Panama when they were recruiting people for the Panama Canal, you know, when the war started. And that was all the war effort because I had to work as a commissary there. And the money wasn't all that, but it was something. And people going away, that's the only way you see people. Most Jamaicans who have at that time had anything, they had travelled. They didn't make it at home because very few people could work and get well off, you know, with the wages they earn in Jamaica. Some people could do because, I mean, there are quite a number of people, if they earn £5, they still save something. It doesn't matter what. If you're made that way, you could. But not everyone could.
Windrush, 75 Years of Modern Britain by Mike and Trevor Phillips, is narrated by the authors and runs for 20 hours and 58 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB Helpline for more information. RNIB. See differently.
Celebrating 20 years of RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, I'm Robert Kirkwood, and I produce and present shows about books and accessible reading for RNIB Connect Radio. I've been with RNIB for around 23 years, starting off as a talking book engineer. My favourite moment working for RNIB Connect Radio actually lasted a week when I covered the 5th Africa Forum on Blindness, which took place in Accra in Ghana. It was a real eye-opener, pun intended, to discover both high-tech and low-tech solutions people had to tackle sight loss in rural Africa.
RNIB Connect Radio, celebrating 20 years of broadcasting around the UK.
And finally, on today's show, a return to Mia Kujnar and the books of her life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
So from childhood, it has to be Northern Lights by Philip Pullman, which I know is not hugely original. I'm pretty sure half of all authors say the same thing about their favourite childhood book, you know, if you're of a certain age. But it did have a deep impact on me. I've reread it so many times now, but I would say it didn't have a big impact on me in terms of writing my own stories, but more to do with my other love, which is travelling. And I've actually, as an adult, travelled to Arctic Norway 3 times now. So I've always loved adventure stories, and being a keen traveller myself, reading and rereading Lyra's adventures in the far north, it really stirred me.
Lyra had to adjust to her new sense of her own story, and that couldn't be done in a day. To see Lord Asriel as her father was one thing, but to accept Mrs. Coulter as her mother was nowhere near so easy. A couple of months ago, she would have rejoiced, of course, and she knew that too, and felt confused. But Being Lyra, she didn't fret about it for long, for there was the Fen town to explore and many Egyptian children to amaze. Before the 3 days were up, she was an expert with a punt, in her eyes at least, and she had gathered a gang of urchins about her with tales of her mighty father, so unjustly made captive. And then, one evening, the Turkish ambassador was a guest at Jordan for dinner, and he was under orders from the Sultan himself to kill my father, right? And he had a ring on his finger with a hollow stone full of poison. And when the wine come round, he made as if to reach across my father's glass as he sprinkled the poison in. It was done so quick that no one else saw him, but...
What sort of poison? Demanded a thin-faced girl.
Poison out of a special Turkish serpent, Lyra invented. What they catch by playing a pipe to lure out, and then they throw it a sponge soaked in honey, and the serpent bites it and can't get his fangs free. And they catch it and milk the venom out of it. Anyway, my father, he seen what the Turk done, and he says, Gentlemen, I want to propose a toast of friendship between Jordan College and the College of Izmir, which was the college the Turkish ambassador belonged to. And to show our willingness to be friends, he says, we'll swap glasses and drink each other's wine. And the ambassador was in a fix then, because he couldn't refuse to drink without giving deadly insult, and he couldn't drink it because he knew it was poisoned. He went pale, and he fainted right away at the table. And when he come round, they was all sitting there waiting and looking at him, and then he had to either drink the poison or own up. So what did he do? He drunk it. It took him 5 whole minutes to die, and he was in torment all the time. Did you see it happen? No, because girls ain't allowed at the eye table, but I seen his body afterwards when they laid him out. His skin was all withered like an old apple, and his eyes were staring from his head. In fact, they had to push him back in the sockets. And so on.
Philip Pullman's Northern Lights, his Dark Materials trilogy, Book 1, is available from RNIB Talking Books, as narrated by David Thorne. Is there a book on a rainy day you would curl up with and reread?
Okay, so my rainy day comfort rereads have to be anything cosy and autumnal, and because I'm a great fan of magic, preferably witchy, that I can just read while it's raining outside under a fluffy blanket with a mug of hot chocolate. So some of favourites that would fit into that category are the Threadneedle series by Carrie Thomas. The audiobook is narrated by Bea Holland, which is a witchy fantasy set in, I think it's modern day London, or it might be 90s London. Can't quite remember, but I will be rereading it very soon and I'm very excited. Then you have The XX, which is a witchy rom-com, a romantic comedy, which is great fun. And that's by Erin Sterling, narrated by Caitlin Davies. And then possibly one of my most recent favourite books that is just so, so cosy is The Very Secret Society of Irregular Witches by Sangu Mandana, narrated by Samara McLaren. And I cannot recommend that one enough. Well, all of them really, but that one I'm dying to reread, but I'm holding off until it's the perfect weather.
Now, if you were to pick just one, what one would you pick?
I would say The Very Secret Society of Irregular Witches, because it's just so cozy. And even if you're not a huge fan of magic or fantasy, it's very accessible. It's set in modern day England. And if you like cozy shows like The Gilmore Girls or anything set in a small town, it's just perfect with just a little nice little dose of witchiness. It's just got so much heart to it as well. And yeah, I loved it.
As rain dripped steadily down from the cold, muddy grey sky, Primrose cleared her throat.
How are we all, dears?
Wet, Mika couldn't resist pointing out.
Your contribution is noted, thank you, Poppet,
said Primrose, unperturbed. We're pretending to be a book club, Primrose, Mika replied, exasperated. We don't need to hide in the middle of nowhere. Why couldn't we just meet for a sodding coffee somewhere with central heating?
I, for one, think our safety is worth more than our comfort,
Primrose said, and then went straight for the jugular. But considering the most irregular way you spend your time, dear, I am not in the least surprised that you don't seem to feel the same way. Mika sighed. She'd walked right into that one. At 31, she was a rather young witch in a group that mostly skewed older. While she didn't exactly have a handy spreadsheet with each witch's age on it, she was quite sure that she, Hilda Kim and Sophie Clark, were the only ones this side of 40. So she should perhaps have been a lot more intimidated by Primrose than she actually was. But the truth was, she knew Primrose a lot better than most of the other witches here. And she and Primrose had had a wobbly relationship since before Mika could remember. The problem, really, was that witches were always orphans. According to Primrose, this was because of a spell that went wrong in some bygone era. Mika was certain this tale was a figment of Primrose's imagination, but she also had no better explanation because the fact remained. When a witch was born, she would find herself orphaned shortly thereafter. It didn't matter where in the world the witch was born, and the cause of death could be anything from innocuous illnesses to everyday accidents. But it was inevitable. Some witches were then raised by grandparents or other relatives, and in time came to discover the existence of their own magic. All things considered, assuming that they weren't catastrophically reckless with their spell work, they grew up to lead quite normal lives. But some witches, like Mika, were the daughters of witches. And some of those witches, like Mika, were also the granddaughters of witches. It was unusual, certainly. Most witches, only too mindful of the axe over their heads, chose not to have children of their own, but it did sometimes happen. And so, when Mika Moon, the orphaned child of an orphaned child of an orphaned child, found herself left in the care of an overworked social worker in India in the early 90s, Primrose found her, brought her to England and deposited her in a perfectly proper, comfortable home with perfectly proper, comfortable nannies. Mika remembered none of this, of course, but she remembered growing up in the care of nannies and tutors of all genders, ethnicities and temperaments, each of whom was only permitted to stay for as long as it took to catch a glimpse of something magical, which was not long before they were replaced.
The Very Secret Society of Irregular Witches by Sangu Mandana is narrated by Samara McLaren and is available commercially. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but some you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
Well, I haven't been doing much reading recently, to be completely honest with you, because I've been on a huge writing spree. But the last book I did read was called Girl, Goddess, Queen, which is a young adult Hades and Persephone retelling. So it's by B. Fitzgerald, narrated by Jenny Walser. And it's just very punchy and fun. It's about a young Persephone who, I mean, she definitely does not want to get married. So she jumps into hell to avoid it, where she comes face to face with Hades himself. And yeah, lots of fun and chaos and big plans and things ensue.
When they asked me what I wanted, I said, the world.
And what would you do with the world? My father asked. His words were lined with sharp edges, but I didn't catch their threat until Mother squeezed my shoulder. Her fingers were too hard to be a comfort. A warning, perhaps? Or a threat of her own? I stared from God to God, no one giving me any indication of what I'd done wrong. They had asked me a simple question. I had given a simple response. Now everyone watched me from the shaded porticos of the Megaron, their faces distorted in the reflections on the bronze pillars that ringed the throne hall. I had no idea what they wanted, no idea why everyone suddenly seemed tense. A few people glanced to my father, whose glower was so fierce he could have passed for one of his own statues. I considered his question, my mother's nails digging deeper with every passing second that I remained wordless. I'd fill it with flowers, I decided. A heartbeat as the words landed. Then my father laughed. Long. Loud. The kind of noise that had me shrinking into my chair. The assembled gods joined in a split second too late. I wanted to turn to my mother, to see if I'd answered correctly. But her hands held me in place, though her nails were less piercing. She hadn't let me out of her sight all evening. "It is good practice to be wary around strangers, my child," she had said. But these people weren't strangers, at least not to my mother. They were her sisters and brothers, in arms, if not in blood. They were gods she had known her entire life. I'd wanted to know more, but "don't ask questions, my child," was mother's favourite saying. Still, at least all this "my child" nonsense would stop soon. I was 8 years old, or thereabouts. It's hard to keep track when you're immortal, and all the other gods had, until that point, been locked in a war against the Lord of Time, who shifted it about as he pleased. But regardless of my age, it was my Amphidromia, the day a child receives their name. And, as I was a goddess, I was also due to receive my domain, the aspect of the world that I would be responsible for. "Very well," Father said, rising from his throne. The laughing strangers fell silent at once. "Let it be so." He paused, the corners of his lips twitching as he took in the concerned expressions of the other gods, particularly the other members of the council who sat to either side of him. They were his advisers, and now they nudged each other and whispered, keen to hear his judgment. Then Father smiled, though nothing about it eased the tension. "Goddess of the flowers, it is."
Girl Goddess Queen by Bea Fitzgerald is narrated by Jenny Walser and is available both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books. And once again, Mia, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's all we've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 7 a.m. with a different tale at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.